I'd like now to welcome Dee Dee Feldman. She was New Mexico State Senator from 1997 to 2012. She's author of the new book, Inside the New Mexico Senate, Boots, Suits, and Citizens. And she will be at Collected Works Bookstore this Sunday, the 16th of February at 11 in the morning, in conversation with KSFR radio host Zuby Wilson. It's a production of Journey Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I always used to listen to your program on the way to the session when I stayed here in Santa Fe, and so listened every morning.
Excellent. Well, thanks. So why did you decide in the first place to run for state senator?
Well, I had helped a lot of other women run for office during the 1980s, and I had run myself for the city council in Albuquerque in 1995 and lost by 9 votes. So when an opening occurred, the senator from my area retired after 20 years, I decided that I could do this just as well as anyone else. And so I ran in an open primary and won and was in the New Mexico Senate for 16 years.
It's such an interesting description in your book of how you run a campaign. And of course, it's changed since you ran your campaign in 1996. But basically, there's, even in a small state like New Mexico, there's all kinds of machines. And if your sign is in particular people's front yard,
yes,
then you've got an advantage. And
yes,
you have to basically, on some level, kind of get permission to run.
Well, I think that's true. And in New Mexico, and this is a great thing about New Mexico, we still do retail politics. It's still in a legislative race, less true in a statewide race.
What does retail mean?
Retail means you go person to person. You go door to door. You sell yourself, you sell your views, and you try to gain the loyalty of people in your neighborhood or people in surrounding neighborhoods. And it's often a very personal business.
And you literally wrote thank you notes.
Oh yes, I literally wrote, my entree was always, what are some of your concerns about the state? And that would really open the door. And people opened the door to me, because it's rare that somebody knocks on your, I mean, politicians are the last door-to-door salesmen in the United States. And so it's pretty surprising when somebody knocks on your door and is not a Jehovah's Witness or is not selling candy for the school and actually wants to be serious and talk about problems and concerns that you might have.
And there's some little funny asides, like what happens when you go to the house of a Jehovah's Witness and knock on their door.
You usually leave with more literature than you drop off, because, of course, Jehovah's Witnesses do not vote.
Now, when you run for an office, like state senator, as you did, and you win, there have been a lot of people, not only the people who are your constituents who you talked to when you went door to door, but people who really supported your campaign in very big and specific ways. What do they then want in return?
Well, they want your loyalty to them and their beliefs and their stands. This is the way I try to approach it, they want an explanation. They want an explanation and an education on the issues. And so if the elected official diverges from what the constituents want, they want to know why. They want to know whether the facts are different, whether the governor felt another way, exactly what the situation was, rather than just blind voting on a party line or blind. At least this is the way my constituents were. And every year I did a constituent survey to find out what my constituents wanted. I think most legislators in New Mexico, because they do not have staff throughout the year and do not have a budget to do constituent surveys, they're not always clear about what their constituents really feel about some of the very complex issues that face New Mexico.
It's an interesting state to be in because, as you describe in lots of different ways, it's a small state. There's only 2 million people or so in the state. There's this kind of sense that everybody knows each other. And it's also a citizen legislature, which, as you as you point out, really has some of its own challenges.
Yes, it does, but it has some of its own advantages. However, I think at this point, the idea of a citizen legislature where everybody keeps their own job and is not a professional paid legislator full-time in Santa Fe, we're experiencing some of the downsides of that right now. And the downsides are, because we have such short sessions, we don't always get everything done in that time frame. And a lot of things drop by the wayside. Often they're the things that involve change.
Right.
And so there's also the problem of conflict of interest. When everyone keeps their own occupation, their own job, then there's an awful lot of votes that are taken that affect their livelihood. And I found it fairly rare for legislators to recuse themselves from votes. And in some cases, that can present a problem.
So there's real conflicts of interest that aren't quite admitted to?
That's right. It's sort of unstated. It's a sort of cost of doing business in a citizen legislature. And sometimes people cross the line. For example, in the 1990s, I give an example of how one consultant promised to get a contract from the state funds, and he was actually guilty of a crime there and ended up in jail.
When you say consultant...
He was a consultant, and this is...
He was a consultant and a legislator.
Yes, and this is very common. A lot of legislators, because we're not paid full-time, and we don't serve full-time, and just get a per diem for the amount of time you're in session or are in a committee, they have their own independent business. And because it's difficult for somebody to be a teacher or a full-time worker, often it's the independent insurance agents, it's the real estate appraisers, the lawyers that have their own practice, and a huge number of retired people in the legislature.
I mean, you pointed out that the people in the legislature tend to be the three R's: rich, retired, and resourceful.
Yes, you have to be resourceful if you're going to continue to earn a living. But I found it very difficult, and my own business went down dramatically. I was one of those. I had a small public relations business, and I thought that being in the legislature was going to be a great boon to that. On the other hand, what happened was people then wanted to hire me because I was a legislator and because I might be able to have some influence with my colleagues or influence with the city council in Albuquerque, and I didn't feel that was right. But, you know, I still had to earn a living. And I was lucky in my case that my husband is a home builder and was able, in effect, to subsidize my service there. And I think that's what you'll find for most of the 112 legislators in New Mexico. And that is, most of them have someone else subsidizing their service. They're either retired or they have a spouse that is able to support them. And that's really unfortunate, because that does not mean that there's, or that means that there is not a cross-section of New Mexico in the legislature. They're mostly older, they're mostly retired, and they're mostly independent business people.
We're talking to Dee Dee Feldman about her new book, Inside the New Mexico Senate. You mentioned at a certain point in the book a kind of sadness that you felt when a poll came out that showed that most New Mexicans perceived the legislature as being run by special interests. How much of that is, in fact, true?
Well, there's a large part of my book that is devoted to the suits. That's the boots, suits, and citizens part. And the suits are the lobbyists who represent special interests. And in fact, there is a lot of control and influence, I should say, exerted by lobbyists in New Mexico. And the public feels that most of what goes on in the New Mexico legislature is dictated by special interests. And I think you saw this, Mary Charlotte, just recently Common Cause did a poll in which 90% of the respondents said that elected officials were more influenced by special interests than by their own voters. So that's a concern, even if it's just a perception. because then that discourages people from participating in the whole system.
And it also encourages people like those who came to you to do PR because they really were special interests in some way trying to influence the legislature.
Yes, yes, indeed, it does. And there's a lot of this book that actually is connecting the dots between special interest money from the big special interests, big tobacco, big pharma, oil and gas, some of the other really big moneyed interests in Santa Fe. And does it actually affect our policies when it comes to prescription drugs, when it comes to tobacco, when it comes to health care? And I think that you can see very, very clearly that it does, but also that advocates who have a good strategy and who understand the system are often able to overcome those special interests.
And sometimes they do it, as you say, there is tremendous power in a good story.
Yes, there's tremendous power in a good story. And this, again, goes back to the fact that we're a small state and people are connected and sometimes people are family. And even the special interests, unfortunately, in many cases are considered to be family within the New Mexico legislature. Sometimes the lobbyists actually are related to the legislators or are former legislators themselves. But still, that can be overcome by human stories. And sometimes those stories are connected very closely to the legislator's personal background themselves. For example, we had a senator whose family was decimated by a DWI accident, and that was Senator Kent Cravens, and that changed DWI policy in New Mexico. We had another senator, Tim Jennings, whose daughter had Down syndrome, and that also changed the way the legislature approached developmental disabilities. So good stories in association with good leadership, also united leadership in the legislature, can put across some very unlikely things like medical marijuana. That's probably a good example of how people came to the legislature and their very presence, there was a story because we could see them wasting away each year. And the presence of Aaron Armstrong and Essie DuBonnet, two of the advocates that worked in association with the Drug Policy Alliance, they were ultimately convincing to the legislature after a number of years, a conservative legislature, that this was a matter of compassion rather than actually drug policy. And so that measure, medical marijuana, passed the Senate almost unanimously, which is just really astounding when you consider, well, just recently, the legalization of marijuana was defeated in a Senate committee.
But it was so close that it makes you think maybe next year it'll
yes,
be different.
It was close. And it also makes you think, well, maybe with a change in advocacy method that it could be different.
There are various divides in New Mexico, not only Democrat and Republican, but urban and rural. What does this urban and rural difference look like? I mean, besides the outfits.
Besides the outfits, yeah, and the hats. You see cowboy hats all over the legislature. I think it's very striking. And in fact, a friend of mine, who's a lobbyist for the Association of Counties, said to me when I first went there, oh, well, that's a hat bill. Oh, a hat bill. I had no idea what she was talking about. But those were the bills that attracted the rural interests. And quite often these were water bills. This might have to do with acequias. It might have to do with agriculture. And there is a big split between those in the eastern and the southern part of the state and the two urban areas, Albuquerque and Santa Fe. And there's quite a hostility, I would say, almost, to Santa Fe and to Albuquerque from some of the rural areas, which are losing population, which have a shortage of healthcare personnel, for example, and a shortage of a lot of things, and whose children are migrating to the urban areas. There's a lot of resentment there because the rural areas feel that all the resources go to the University of New Mexico, or all the resources go to build a train connecting the two major urban areas while their roads are deteriorating out near Jal or some other rural area. However, I do think that in many ways we are controlled by the rural interests in the legislature, in that every 10 years at redistricting time, the outcomes that the lines that the legislature draw never really accurately reflect the decline in population from the rural areas. And also, it's a very conservative atmosphere. You know, the fact that the legislature only meets for 1 month in an even-numbered years and 2 months in an odd-numbered year, this is based on a ranching and farming economy. Yeah. This was in 1912 when farmers and ranchers were inactive, and so they had time to meet in Santa Fe. And they don't want to meet much longer. Every year, practically, there's a bill that is introduced that would extend the session to 45 days, for example, in an even-numbered year like now. Because, you know, hundreds of bills are left on the table every time there's sine die. But it's resisted because many of the rural folks feel that the longer the legislature is in session, the more danger there is to ordinary citizens of New Mexico from excessive regulation or more taxation.
I do wonder about that because on the one hand, you could have more time to get stuff done, but whether it's a 60-day or a 30-day session, from my perspective, looking at it from the outside, and I'm certainly not involved in the machinations of the legislature, but it seems like nobody ever does anything for the first half, no matter how long the session is, and then there's a big rush to finish everything at the end.
Maybe that's human nature. And the cover of my book is actually of mariachis and baile folclorico dancing. We had endless performances by school kids. And the first chapter is called Cue the Mariachis. And that's right. I mean, the first part of the session is mostly ceremonial. You know, they always say, well, that's because we're still getting the bills printed up. Well, you know, if there was a little bit more modernization, maybe they wouldn't even need the bills printed up. Everybody could be viewing the bills on their computer, and a lot more could be done. But, you know, I find that the legislature is hidebound in many respects. They resisted transparency to the bitter end when it came to opening conference committees, which is really where the budget takes its final form to the public. And now I think we have in this session a bill that would allow for the archiving of webcasts that are made during the session. We fought long and hard, and it was a bipartisan effort to try to get committees and floor sessions webcast. There was resistance, bitter resistance from the leadership of that. And they approved it only with the proviso that the broadcasts not be archived so that they could not later be used for political purposes, which, you know, really is a detriment to historians, to folks that can't go to Santa Fe or can't view it that particular day on their own computer. And, you know, it's just really, I think, out of touch with the technological capabilities we have today.
We're talking to Dee Dee Feldman about her new book, Inside the New Mexico Senate, Boots, Suits, and Citizens. Now, we have, as you write about in your book, a majority-minority state. We have a majority of Hispanic and Native American people and of a few other quote-unquote minority groups. And most Hispanic legislators are historically Democrats. Why the connection between those two things?
That wasn't always the case. Hispanics in the early part of the 1900s, up to around 1930, 1938 or so, were Republicans. But then when FDR was president, I think that the New Deal came in, The WPA came in. Clyde Tingley was the mayor of Albuquerque. And the Hispanic population began to see the wisdom, in my view, of being Democrats. And they are loyal Democrats. Quite often in northern New Mexico, this is where Democratic presidential candidates will come, whether they be John Kerry, whether they be John Kennedy. And people in Española and northern New Mexico are still talking about John Kennedy's visit to northern New Mexico.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Obama came here, too.
And Obama came as well. And, you know, Obama's gathering in Albuquerque in 2008 was the largest political gathering that had ever happened in the state of New Mexico. It was at the University of New Mexico.
Now, the Democratic Party stays in power in the legislature decade after decade after decade. At the same time, they seem disorganized and ununified.
What?
What's going on?
Well, you know, that's what Mark Twain said about the Democratic Party. I don't belong to a organized political party. I'm a Democrat. And we have a big tent, of course, and many different ethnicities, and of course, male and female, as well as ages and philosophies. And this is the thing I think that's so frustrating to mainline Democrats, especially in the Senate. And I would call myself kind of a mainline Democrat or traditional Democrat, is that, you know, there's a faction of the Senate Democrats who always are from the southern part of the state or are conservative Democrats from the east side. We had Senator Tim Jennings, and we have now, as president pro tem of the Senate, Senator Mary Kay Papin from Las Cruces, and as the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator John Arthur Smith. All of those were very conservative Democrats. And it's almost kind of an accident of history, just as it is an accident of history that, you know, the Democratic Party was strong in the southern part of the United States after the Civil War up until the Nixon era, that these folks are Democrats, because many of their constituents are Republicans. Tim Jennings eventually succumbed to the fact that most of his constituents had been Republicans for years over there in Roswell. But as a result of that, there's almost always in the Senate been a coalition. I write about that. I write about Richard Romero's upsetting Senator Manny Aragon in 2001, and then Senator Tim Jennings, and also Senator Mary Kay Papin. These folks were elected as pro tem in the Senate with the Republican votes, and maybe three or four Democratic votes. The nominee of the Democratic caucus had been somebody else.
There is a very interesting, and I think for people who are New Mexicans who follow New Mexican politics or have done so over the years, or even if you haven't, I mean, you write about the various leaders we've had, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, basically. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about the rise and fall of Manny Aragon. He's such an interesting character.
It's almost like a Greek tragedy, really.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Senator Aragon was considered to be the best and the brightest, I would say, of Democrats in New Mexico through most of the 1990s. And yet, of course, he's just now getting out of federal prison, having been convicted. It was really a plea bargain that happened there, and he pled guilty to corruption using state funds for the Metro Courthouse in Albuquerque and skimming off up to $600,000. However, you know, he was very committed to his causes, and his causes were the underprivileged, were the traditional liberal women, children, civil liberties. He was the first one to support the legalization of marijuana, to support Tibetan refugees here in Santa Fe, to expand Medicaid, to include a lot more children and pregnant women than had been the case during the 1990s. And he fought bitterly for the causes that he, and brilliantly for the causes that he believed in. And they were often the same causes that I believed in. Civil liberties, environmental protection. As time went on, he began doing everything. More and more power accrued to him in the Senate. The Senate Finance Committee did less and less, and he did the budget himself in the basement in his office with his friends, and not in a democratic manner. And finally, the body rebelled against that because they were out, and he was in, and there were instances of conflict of interest. He was the lobbyist for Wackenhut, which was a private prison operation, at the same time that we were discussing whether to privatize our prisons here in New Mexico. Yeah. He was a lobbyist out of New Mexico, he said, but he resisted giving up that contract. And this is, we were talking about conflict of interest earlier. He resisted that and finally did, but it damaged a lot of his fellow Democrats and gave the opposition a lot of fuel. So finally, he was overthrown by a coalition of Republicans and three Democrats, Richard Romero, Leonard Socey, and Cisco McSorley. And this was a very bitter time in the history of the New Mexico Senate, the year 2001. There were repeated efforts to bring the new pro tem, Richard Romero, down. And it was just very difficult. However, the end of the story was that I think that the senators emerged better off in the end because they each rose to the occasion of not just voting on party lines and on the basis of loyalty to one person. They had to make up their minds on the basis of each issue as it came up. And they had to exert leadership as committee chairs rather than getting direction from an all-powerful leader. Yeah. So in the end, the next year, Senator Romero was able to bring together Republicans and Democrats to put forward a redistricting map that the governor signed. It was Governor Johnson at the time. It did not go to court. It was one of the few redistricting maps that has been actually passed through the process. And he also, the following year, was able to get the legislature to call itself back into extraordinary session. This was the only time in the history of New Mexico, I think, that this has been done. Maybe it was done one other time, way back when. But anyway, we called ourselves back into special session. It wasn't the governor usually calls a special session. We called ourselves back into special session. We overrode the governor's veto of the budget. This was the second veto he had, the second budget he had vetoed that year, and we immediately passed another budget and went home all in one day. It was one of the finest hours of the New Mexico legislature, I believe.
We're talking to former New Mexico State Senator Dee Dee Feldman about her book Inside the New Mexico Senate, Boots, Suits, and Citizens. Now, the dynamics of the Senate, the dynamics of the legislature seem to be based, and it's just so interesting to be reading, you know, an insider's view of it, they seem to be based on a kind of long-term male culture. What do you think it would be like if there were, say, 30 to 50% women in the legislature? How would it be different?
Well, that's a good question. We don't know. Actually, the proportion of women in the New Mexico Senate went down in the last election, and a number of the women quit. I did Senator Cynthia Nava, Senator Bernadette Sanchez, and others. Senator Mary Jane Garcia was defeated. These were actually committee chairs and the whip of the Senate. So that was part of the leadership. You could make an argument that that women in the New Mexico Senate were in leadership positions, particularly committee chairs. And of course, now there are fewer of those women committee chairs, and there are fewer women in leadership positions in the Senate. So, how would it look different? It's hard to tell. I was always disappointed that the women in the Senate and even in the legislature itself did not coalesce more. In other states, there are women's caucuses, and the caucus will adopt a bill and on a bipartisan basis and try to put forward that bill that might benefit women and children, or that might have a special significance for the victims of domestic violence, or additional protection for rape victims, and so on. We were never able to accomplish that, except for one year. I do remember we had a bill that we together, the House and Senate women, sponsored, and we were able to pass that. It was not a real important or controversial bill, but we never did have a caucus, and I think that's something that the women in the Senate and the House should continue to explore.
Now, when you came in, what kind of legislation were you looking to promote, and how did that change as the years go by? You were there for 16 years.
Yeah. Well, when I came in, I was elected as a reformer. That's the way I promoted myself to folks in my district, and I was elected in that, and I vowed to myself that every year I would introduce a bill that would reform the way campaigns were run in New Mexico to reduce the influence of money and special interests. And I also vowed to become involved with health care and push for health care reform so that more New Mexicans could have accessible and affordable insurance and care here in New Mexico, because we had the second lowest number of people who actually had health care insurance here in New Mexico during my entire term.
I think the issue of reforming the way campaigns are run, campaign finance reform, to stand up to these special interest lobbies is incredibly important. I mean, you write about the NRA and tobacco and pharmaceuticals, not to mention we'll get in a moment to the fireworks industry, but some of these others, like the NRA and tobacco and so on, are working on a state level to get stuff done that they can't get done on a national level. And so basically they run into states like New Mexico with a lot of money, a lot of charm, a lot of dinners, and try to exert their influence. And it's standing up to that is tricky business.
Well, we're a cheap date here in New Mexico in terms of how much our campaigns cost, and the fact that legislators are not paid and need to eat at night, spend their per diem on hotel rooms, especially if they're from outside of Albuquerque or Santa Fe. And so there's a lot of lobbyists who come from out of state, and especially when an issue like, let's say, a statewide ban on indoor smoking comes up, or when an effort to reduce the price of prescription drugs comes up, you will find a large number of lobbyists from out of state. And, you know, I think to their credit, many New Mexico legislators can see that, you know, that these folks are from out of state and resist it and make their decision based on the fact. But remember that some of the lobbyists for these big industries, tobacco, fireworks, prescription drugs, are very well-known local fixtures, often former senators or representatives who, you know, might have been the best man at the committee chair's wedding.
Right.
And the consumer advocates are, you know, they have their own kind of power because they're voters in individual districts. But quite often they're not as organized as are the big lobbyists who are there all the time, at the Senate and at the House, even late at night, when things happen unexpectedly, when there's an amendment proposed to a bill that the citizen advocates, you know, they're still getting their. They're still looking for a parking place out there someplace, and the others know exactly what the pressure points are.
I mean, consumer advocates, they don't gain anything financially by winning. It's just that the quality of life gets better. For example, the indoor smoking ban, which I would like to say thank you very much because that changed my life for the better and a lot of people's lives for the better, and I can't even imagine at this point going into a restaurant where they're smoking or a dance club where they're smoking. But
remember, the Restaurant Association opposed that for many years.
Yeah.
And it took a concerted effort on the part of citizens and on the part of reformers, you know, using good stories of musicians who had to play in these restaurants and how they objected to being exposed to secondhand smoke. It took years to get that through, and it was only because those advocates really understood the system. Usually there's a nonprofit group that leads the charge. So the Cancer Society, for example, in that instance. And you know, these nonprofits often are attacked bitterly by the legislators as being their own special interest.
But they have nothing to gain. That's the difference. Tobacco makes money if they're smoking indoors. The Cancer Society doesn't make money. All they do is promote public health.
Well, I totally agree. However, legislators, when pushed up against the wall, will start asking for what is the salary of the executive director of the nonprofit that is proposing this consumer reform. It gets really personal and really ugly when reformers and advocates are trying to buck special interests and create change.
Now, one of the things that is quite amazing is that we cannot pass legislation to ban fireworks during droughts, and that's not even a partisan issue. I mean, Governor Martinez was all for it, and it still didn't pass.
Right. Now, I understand that this year in the legislature there is a bill that would give cities and counties the right to ban some fireworks, and we'll see how far that gets. I certainly did not have success when I tried it twice in the legislature, even with Governor Martinez's support. I think Representative Emily Kane tried it last year and was also run up against a brick wall of this relatively small industry, the fireworks industry. But they have very well-placed lobbyists who are friendly with the committee chairs who have the power to kill these bills. And I think that's something that you have to understand as an advocate for any cause, is the fact that it's much easier to kill a bill in the New Mexico legislature than it is to advance a change. And the bills usually die in committees at the hands of a skillful committee chair who can either not hear the bill at all or maneuver so that it is heard late and it never sees the light of day.
One of the things that I find a little puzzling is that legislative session after session, there is relatively little focus on the issue of water, which seems like it should be one of the most large and central issues facing our state, and that it would be something where rural and urban could come together because clean water is of interest to all of us.
Well, number one, I think water does occupy the legislature, and certainly I, for 12 years I served on the Interim Water Committee, which considered these issues all the time. But it is not a uniting issue. It is a divisive issue between the rural and the urban interests. And the rural interests, of course, are interested in preserving water rights for agriculture, and the urban interests have their own priorities for municipal use, for clean water, as you say, and the mining industry needs water for their operations. They also are responsible for a degree of water pollution, and so those regulations become a flashpoint during most sessions. But water, I think, this year is going to get some money for infrastructure and water projects in rural areas, but that doesn't really deal with the basic problem, which is the drought and the shortage of water, and our inability to budget our water needs and supplies. And, you know, that's a matter of law. That's a matter of water rights that need to be sold or swapped for the good of the people of New Mexico. And there's always a big dispute as to what is in the best interest of the people of New Mexico and which people.
We're talking to Dee Dee Feldman about her book, Inside the New Mexico Senate, Boots, Suits, and Citizens. Looking at legislatures, whether it be on a national level or on a state level, I tend to look at things like, for example, single-payer health care and think this is a no-brainer. I mean, it's cheaper, it's more fair, it's easier for doctors. Very few people are madly in love with insurance companies. We pay an awful lot of money to them and don't get all that much in return a lot of the times. And yet, these are divisive issues.
These are very divisive issues. Healthcare in particular is a very complex issue because everybody has a financial stake in it, and it's not a slam dunk. New Mexico has considered the single-payer system since, I think, 1991, and it's been turned down every year, and that's because every change in the health care system that you make results in financial loss for one sector of the system, whether it be hospitals, whether it be insurance companies, whether it be providers. So it's very difficult to get an overall reform of health care provide affordable, accessible health care for all because it's such a complex system. We've tried it in New Mexico. Governor Richardson tried in 2008 with his health solutions plan, which was very much like Romney Care, and it did not pass because of some personal animosities. It could have passed, but it did not pass because of some personal animosities between senators and the governor. And yet, New Mexicans and legislators are willing to do smaller scale reforms that will, for example, allow parents to put their kids on their insurance policy or prevent discrimination against women in the pricing of insurance policies or prevent insurance companies from rescinding policies when people get ill. Those are all things that we passed in New Mexico. And we weren't able to get a big package to incorporate all those with a Medicaid expansion and a prohibition against insurance companies discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions. That was too big. That was too much counter to the financial interests of the others. But of the special interests. But we were able to get those piecemeal reforms. And those piecemeal reforms now, they all became part of the Affordable Care Act of Obamacare.
So those piecemeal reforms, even when you don't get the big package, as you write, often have the effect of kind of chipping away to getting what you want in the long run.
Well, they do. They do that. And also, because states are laboratories of democracy, the federal government will look at state reforms and state policies and see whether they're working or whether it's something they could adopt on a much larger scale. And that's what happened in this case.
Now, having been in the New Mexico Senate for as long as you were and having seen so many different issues and ethics violations and redistricting and so on, what would you like to see if you could do some reforms, you ran as a reformer, to really make the state a better and fairer place? What are some of the things you would do?
Well, I tick them off in the last chapter of the book, and I think that there are things that keep coming up every time the legislature meets, and that is the institution of an ethics commission, an independent ethics commission, idea of a nonpartisan independent redistricting group so that somebody outside the legislature is drawing the lines of districts instead of legislators picking their own voters.
And that way it couldn't be vetoed in the same way that happens now and then go to court, which is a very laborious process.
Well, it depends upon how it's set up, of course. And it would require a constitutional amendment. But other states are doing it, Arizona, California, and they have set it up in different ways. Some of it still has to come back to the legislature. Others becomes law without legislative action or governor's action. But I think the basic thing is to think about these foundational things. These foundational things like how campaigns are run, how districts are drawn. These are all the things that are leading to gridlock right now.
How elections are conducted.
I'm a supporter of public financing. I sponsored two bills that gave us public financing for the PRC and for statewide courts. We need to expand that more in New Mexico. But, of course, for all these things, legislators are very unwilling to do it for themselves. They might be willing to do it for somebody over there at the PRC or in the judicial system. But when they want to when somebody wants to change the way they are elected, change the game by which those legislators won in order to get there, it becomes very, very difficult.
Because they think they might not win the next time if they change the system.
Right. And it's not because they're evil people that way and want to hold on to power, but it's because they're really good people that are trapped in a flawed system. And I think if there were alternatives and some of these reforms were made, like public financing, an ethics commission to draw bright lines in a very gray area of conflict of interest in a citizen legislature, and a nonpartisan redistricting committee, public financing, a ban on lobbying for legislators right after you stop being a legislator, it would help.
Depoliticization of the Secretary of State's office, too.
And I think that's right. I think, it's crazy to have an elected partisan official in charge of elections. I think that we need an elections commission to handle elections and hopefully public financing of elections. I know Peter Wirth has a bill this time to fix the public financing system that we have currently in place. It is doable. It takes a long time, and I think people should not give up.
Dee Dee Feldman was a state senator in New Mexico, in the New Mexico State Legislature from 1997 to 2012. She's author of the new book, Inside the New Mexico Senate, Boots, Suits, and Citizens. And on Sunday, this Sunday, the 16th of February at 11 o'clock, she will be at Collected Works Bookstore. It's a program sponsored by Journey Santa Fe. And she will be talking about the book and discussing it with KSFR radio host Zuby Wilson. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, thank you, Mary Charlotte. I really enjoyed it.